Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. Last reading, we finished the interview with Roger Wheeler, and the rest of that volume, volume two, is a book called The Mind and the Way, which is published by Wisdom Publications, and they gave us permission to print it up and make it available for free distribution, but they didn't give us permission to make an audio representation of it or to put it online. So since this is being recorded and posted, it would be probably a copyright infringement to be reading that book out. So we'll skip right on to volume three. I think you shouldn't feel too deprived, since there are five volumes in the whole series, so I think we won't run out of material. And this volume starts off with the book called The Way It Is, and that's where we'll begin this time. This was published in the around about 90 or 91, and probably the best way to start is to read the initial note before you begin. So this was a book that was edited, like most of Lumpur Sumedho's material, was edited mostly by Ajahn Sujito. He selected the talks and edited them, put them in order. And this is part of his introductory note before the book The Way It Is and the beginning of this volume. This book, volume 3, contains a collection of teachings that Ajahn Sumedho gave in the 1980s, with the exception of, quote, Investigating the Mind, unquote, which was given in 1979. As you will deduce from the people who are referred to, some talks were addressed to the monastic community at Amravati during their winter retreat of 1988. In the monastic retreats, Ajahn Sumedho would often develop a theme from the Buddha's teaching over a couple of months, linking it to other aspects of the Dhamma, embellishing it with accounts of his personal experiences, demonstrating its relevance to the society in general, or using it as an exhortation to the Sangha to live up to their aspiration of awakening. Although it's not possible to render the tonal depth and variety of these talks in a printed work, the mixture of short exhortations and pointers, longer contemplative reflections mingled with the chants that the monks and nuns would recite daily, may suggest the atmosphere of the monastery, as well as the contemplative background against which the teachings were offered. So that winter retreat of 1988, I was present for that, and it was a very memorable time. And I think it was the first time that Lumpur Sumedho began to teach in detail about dependent origination. And so he did that for, I think, three or four winter retreats in a row. Every year he would go into that theme in some detail. And so the order of talks in the Way It Is somewhat related to that winter retreat of 1988, but not absolutely. So the first little talk is called Happiness Forever. We have been meditating, watching our breath, contemplating the inhalation and the exhalation. We are using bare attention, mindfulness of the body while walking, standing, sitting and lying down. Rather than becoming fascinated, we're opening the mind to conditions as they are at the present time. Notice how even in a beautiful place like this, we can really make ourselves miserable. The meaning Amravati. So we didn't have the temple then. This was before the temple was constructed, so it was even being considered a beautiful place when there was the old the old Dhamma Hall slash school, old school assembly hall here on this spot. And we were, I think we were gathered in the sala, as that was our main meditation space during that, that winter retreat of 88. Notice how, even in a beautiful place like this, we can really make ourselves miserable. When we're here, we might want to be somewhere else. And when we're walking, we might want to be sitting. When we're sitting, we might want to be walking. When we're meditating, we're thinking what we'll do after the retreat. Then, after the retreat, we wish we were back here. Hopeless, isn't it? So he's not making a prediction about your minds. So. You might feel that's a prophetic statement, but it was the way that was the way it was then, and it's the way it is now, generally speaking, for our mental states and the way the desire mind works. Before you came to this retreat, you may have been having problems at home and thinking, I can hardly wait until I go on retreat. And then here you wish, I can hardly wait for the retreat to end. Maybe you become very tranquil, sitting there and thinking, I want this to be like this all the time. Or you try to attain that blissful state that you had yesterday, but instead become more and more upset. When you achieve these nice blissful states, you grasp them. But then you have to get something to eat or to do something. So you feel bad at losing the blissful state. Or maybe you haven't been having any blissful states at all, just a lot of miserable memories, anger and frustration arising. But everyone else is blissful, so you feel upset because everyone else seems to be getting something from this retreat except you. This is how we begin to observe that everything changes. Then we have the possibility to observe how we create problems, attach to the good, or create all kinds of complexities around the conditions of the moment. Wanting something we don't have, wanting to keep something we have, or wanting to get rid of it. This is the human problem of desire. We're always looking for something else. I remember as a child wanting a certain toy. I told my mother that if she got me that toy, I'd never want anything ever again. It would completely satisfy me, and I believed it. I wasn't telling her a lie. The only thing that was stopping me from being really happy then was that I didn't have the toy I wanted. So my mother bought the toy and gave it to me. I managed to get some happiness out of it for maybe 5 minutes, and then I had to start wanting something else. So in getting what I wanted, I felt some gratification and happiness, but then desire for something else arose. I remember this so vividly because at that young age, I really believed that if I got that toy that I wanted, I would be happy forever. Only to realize that, quote, happiness forever, unquote, was an impossibility. Oh, that last story bears an uncanny resemblance to my own childhood, and I've often told an identical story. I wouldn't have been the same toy, but it was an exact same dynamic that went on. I grew up in quite a poor family, and so when I was a child, we only got presents either at a birthday or Christmas, and no other times. That was twice in a year. You didn't get presents any other time. And I grew up in the countryside in Kent, and in one of the local villages in Staplehurst, there was a toy shop. And in the window of the toy shop, they had all the various toys sort of stacked up and arranged in a sort of attractive and interesting way. And any of the Brits around here, maybe Venerable Jitasangwaro and Venerable Kosalo, you might remember what were called matchbox toys, little kind of tiny cars and truck and lorries and such. And there was a matchbox toy of a little mauve bubble car. And again, this is back in the early 60s or late 50s. And so a bubble car was actually made by a BMW. It was a three-wheeler car, had two wheels at the front and one wheel at the back. And the door opened on the front. It was round, it looked like a bubble. And I fell in love with this little mauve bubble car in the window of the toy shop in Staplehurst. And so whenever my mother was in the village shopping, and I'd rush up to the window of the toy shop and sort of press my nose against the window and stare at this little mauve bubble car that was my true object of desire. And I said exactly the same. It is kind of eerie that and I meant it exactly the same way that Lumpur Sumato did. And I promised, if I could just have that little mauve bubble car, then I'll never want anything ever again. You know, that's all I want. That will make me happy forever. And it was sincere. You know, just couldn't see beyond that. That's like, life would be complete if I had that. Anyway, I was only about 3 or 4 years old, so it was, didn't have a lot of reflective capacity in the mind. But anyway, as it was approaching my birthday, I think, probably my fourth or maybe my fifth birthday, and then the mauve bubble car vanished from the window of the toy shop, and I was heartbroken. Oh no, it's gone, somebody's bought it. And I didn't notice this smirk on my mother's face. But when I was sort of, I was very tearful as a child, so I was really broken up, and I was crying, and someone's taken my little mauve bubble car, and I wanted it so much. And my mother, she was wouldn't let on, but she had bought it, and then lo and behold, on my birthday, and I unwrapped the presents. Marvelous! This little mauve bubble car appeared, and so I was totally happy. And then was playing with it for a long time, and then the next day a little bit less, the next day a little bit less, and then a few days later, you know, Mom, can I have X, Y, or Z? You said if you got the little mauve bubble car, you'd never want anything ever again. Oh, but, you know, this is different. This is something else. And so it's kind of weird reading these words. I mean, even though I also helped to edit this book, so I'm familiar with it, but even reading it now, it still has a sort of slightly, sort of, almost a feeling of vertigo, because it's so identical to my own experience. But it's probably been going on in the human family for many millennia in exactly the same way. That is a very common human experience, and that's the lie of desire, that if you just get this, you'll be happy. You don't spell it out, and when you have a bit more reflective thinking, you don't assume this will make me happy forever, and I will never want anything else. But without spelling it out, that can be the feeling. That's the felt sense of, oh, I've got to have that. Oh, I can't stand this. If I could just get away from that, then everything would be great. And that's the driving force of desire, is that lie, that deception. And we are so easily drawn into that. And so as the introduction to this retreat, then Lumpur was pointing to that dynamic. And just looking at how the mind works in that way, so that when you spell it out, when you do clarify that and use the quality of reflective wisdom to look at it, then you can think, when I was in the temple, I was thinking, wouldn't it be nice to do walking meditation? And now I'm out walking, I'm thinking, wouldn't it be nice to be back in the temple? And then before the retreat, I was thinking, I can't wait till the winter retreat begins. And now the winter retreat has begun, I'm already planning what I'm going to do in April. Look at that. And so when it's seen and explored, and there is that quality of reflective wisdom brought to bear on it, then the mind is, in a sense, exiting from that realm, from that birth. It's letting go of what it had been born into and seeing that. And it's quite funny, you know, you can find yourself chuckling at how ridiculous, how fickle the mind is, and how it keeps believing these promises that it creates over and over and over. And it's that, in a way, getting used to, getting familiar with that that deceptive process, and recognizing that, oh, it's that tune again, it's that same old story, and then being able to know that, and to not get entangled, not to get born into it, then there's a real freedom, there's a real ease in that, and a delight that comes with that freedom from entanglement. But any particular questions, thoughts? Anybody never had that experience? Okay, well, I'll go on to this second talk. This is called Returning to the Way Things Are. And this was the opening talk of that winter retreat of 1988. And even though it's included in this collection of the book called The Way It Is, it was originally printed in another collection called Seeing the Way that was put together in 1988 by Lumpur Menindo. And so that, but it comes from the same retreat, and it was the introductory talk from that retreat. And so Ajahn Sujito took this talk and put it right at the beginning of this collection, as it introduces many of the themes for that were to follow in that January and February of 88. And in those days, the winter retreat was only 2 months long. It got extended to 3 months after a few years. But in those early years, it was usually just January and February, and then often it would be the Magha Puja gathering at the end of February that would be the sort of the whole community, the different branches would gather together here at Amravati, and that would be the closing of the winter retreat time. So this is called Returning to the Way Things Are. Today is the full moon of January and the beginning of our winter retreat. We can have an all-night meditation sitting tonight to commemorate the auspiciousness of the occasion. It's very fortunate to have an opportunity such as this to devote ourselves for 2 months to one-pointed reflection on Dhamma. The teaching of the Buddha is the understanding of the way things are, capital T, capital W, capital T, capital A, the way things are. Being able to look, to be awake. It means developing attentiveness, brightness and wisdom, developing the Eightfold Path, which we call Bhavana. Now, when we're reflecting on things as they are, we are seeing, quote-unquote, rather than interpreting through a veil of self-view. The big obstacle all of us have to face is this insidious belief in the I am, attachment to self-view. It's so ingrained in us that we're like fish in the water. Water is so much a part of the fish's life that it doesn't notice it. The sensory world we've been swimming in since our birth is like that for us. If we don't take time to observe it for what it really is, then we'll die without getting any the wiser. But this opportunity as a human being has the great advantage for us of our being able to reflect. We can reflect on the water we're swimming in. We can observe the sensory realm for what it is. We're not trying to get rid of it. We're not complicating it by trying to add to it. We're just being aware of it as it is. We're no longer deluding ourselves by appearance, by fears, desires, and all the things that we create in our mind about it. This is what we mean when we use such terms as it is. If you ask someone who is swimming in water, what is water like? Then they simply bring attention to it and say, well, it feels like this, it's this way. Then you ask, how is it exactly? Is it wet or cold or warm or hot? All of these words can describe it. Water can be cold, warm, hot, pleasant, unpleasant, but it's just like this. The sensory realm we're swimming in for a lifetime is this way. It feels like this. You feel it. Sometimes it's pleasant, sometimes it's unpleasant. Most of the time it's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. But always it's just this way. Things come and go and change, and there's nothing that you can depend on as being totally stable. The sensory realm is all energy and change and movement, all flux and flow. Sensory consciousness is this way. Now, we're not judging it. We're not saying it's good or it's bad, or you should like it or you shouldn't. We're just bringing attention to it, like the water. The sensory realm is a realm of feeling. We're born into it and we feel it. From the time the umbilical cord is severed, we're physically independent beings. We're no longer physically tied to anybody else. We feel hunger, we feel pleasure, we feel pain, heat and cold. As we grow, we feel all kinds of things. We feel with the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the body, and with the mind itself. There is the ability to think and remember, to perceive and conceive. All this is feeling. It can be lots of fun and wonderful, but it can also be depressing, mean and miserable. Or it can be neutral, neither pleasant nor painful. So all sensory impingement is the way it is, quote unquote. Pleasure is this way, pain is this way. The feeling of neither pleasure nor pain is this way. To be able to truly reflect on these things, you have to be alert and attentive. Some people think that it's up to me to tell them how it is. Ajahn Sumedho, how should I be feeling right now? But we're not telling anybody how it is. We're being open and receptive to how it is. There's no need to tell someone how it is when they can find out for themselves. So this 2 months of finding out how it is a valuable opportunity. Many human beings, it seems, are not even aware that such a development of wisdom is possible. So this is setting the ground for the retreat and the also the emphasis that Lumpur Sumedho established then and has done ever since, really, in this quality of awareness of the field of experience. He often uses the word consciousness, not so much here as yet, but later on in current times he uses the word consciousness a great deal. But it's recognizing that the world is this felt sensory experience, that's what this is, and that the tendency that we have is to get drawn into the details of the world. We look at people and we say, it's Tan Mununya or Tan Jitasangaro. We say, that's a mat, that's a cushion, this is a microphone, that's Eleonora, that's Sister Nyanasiri, that's a picture of Lumpur Cha for his anniversary. The attention goes to the objects and we are drawn to the names or the details, or the way we define them. And in this this teaching and through the retreat and through so much of Lumpur Sumedho's emphasis, it's a process of learning to not get drawn into the details of experience, to looking at and focusing on the content of experience, but in essence, looking at the suchness of experience. It's this way. So rather than, you know, the floor is white, the microphone is black, the mixture of white and black, it's this way. The habit or the conditioning that we have with the senses and our ancestry as a living animal creature with a vulnerable body and needing to eat and to breathe and to protect ourselves and so forth. We have extraordinarily powerful animal instincts that are based on the senses. So for our ancestors to survive, they had to notice. That's white, that's black, this is dangerous, that's edible. Yeah, that's my territory, that's somebody else's territory. Here is the line. I defend this line of that which is mine, and so on and so forth. Our conditioning to reify, to make the senses and sense objects solid, real, meaningful, is extremely powerful. So that in the practice and that sense of letting go of the content of the sense world, to recognize that the suchness of the quality of experiencing, that's going against a powerful current. It's like, if you've ever tried to walk upstream in a strongly flowing river, it's like wading against the current and the water's pushing you along, or walking into a strong wind. It's like you really have to lean into the power of that, the wind or the water. And that's in many respects what we're doing in terms of Dhamma practice. We feel the pressure of the sense world. This is beautiful, that's ugly, that's yours, that's mine, this is good, that's bad. I approve, I disapprove. And I think it's important to recognize the power and the depth of conditioning around those influences. And so what we're trying to do in practicing Dhamma is going against those basic instinctual forces to see them in a bigger and more complete context. So when there's a feeling of pain, rather than ow, got to get away from that, that's dangerous, it's like, oh, this is the feeling of pain, this is a mental event, it's a feeling that has arisen. Here is the ow experience, it's like this. That takes a lot of work. That's to be able to reflect and to know things without suppression, without say going numb or any way of evading the experience, to fully receive the experience and know it simply as an event in awareness. That takes a lot of work, as we know. But that's really the effort that is being made in Dhamma practice. And that sense of suchness, or it's this way, this is the way it is-ness, that Lumpur Sumedho speaks about over and over again. And that was why Ajahn Sujito gave the title to that collection of teaching of "This is the way it is," because that was very much the theme of that retreat. And then within that, then using the teachings on dependent origination to help recognize those processes of how the mind gets drawn into loving and hating, fearing and hoping, and expecting and regretting and so on, and to get acquainted with the fine analysis of how that process of experiencing works and how the mind gets lost in its experiences, and then also the paticca nirodha, the cessation, the capacity that we have to not be born into things, to not be entangled, for that quality of dukkha nirodha, the cessation of dukkha that is realized when the heart is free of those entanglements, when it is not born into the conditions of sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. So any thoughts, questions? Don't be shy. These readings are for you. Yes, William. Could you use a microphone so people can hear what you're asking? Thank you.
Hello, Ajahn, and Happy New Year. I'm just wondering, is that the same as putting up with harmful people? If we're showing equanimity and someone's causing us harm, are we supposed to sort of show equanimity and kind of get used to it?
Our capacity to act is also part of the way things are. So sometimes when we talk about, say, non-attachment or being with the way things are, people then read that as saying, oh, therefore, freeze, or any kind of action or choice is an imposition upon that suchness. But I think one of the most, and I tend to talk about this quite a lot, is one of the mistakes, I would say that's a really unfortunate mistake to make. Some meditation instructions give that, make that implication, that they sort of steer in that direction, or the languaging of it seems to steer things in that direction. But I would say that's a really unfortunate misunderstanding, so that our ability to act, make choices, and to work with difficult situations or difficult people or, you know, harmful situations, that's also part of the way things are. It's not an imposition or a departure from the way things are. Our capacity to attune to a situation and to take compassionate action is part, that's not separate from the suchness of everything else. And the obvious example to me is that after the Buddha's enlightenment his awakening under the Bodhi tree, then he spent 45 years walking all over northeast India, establishing the teachings, dealing with difficult situations, establishing the Sangha, creating a vast variety of skillful teachings. He took a lot of initiative. There was a lot of decision-making and action that was taken in the process of those 45 years. But during that time, and amidst all of that decision-making and choosing and directing, then his mind was always completely in accord with Dhamma. It wasn't departing from that. So it's maybe a downside of talking about non-attachment or this sort of being with the way it is, that the way it forms in English, it implies a passivity, but peace isn't the same as passivity. So you can be fully at peace while you're taking vigorous action. Just as an easy example also that we can maybe relate to is, you can go for a walk or even a run. you can walk vigorously along. The body is really, pounding away. But inside, you are completely still. There's a quality of ease and stillness, even as the body is taking vigorous exercise. And I think most of us have probably had that kind of an experience. Oh, you know, even though I'm engaged in this activity, and there's a lot of doing going on, I'm not going anywhere. There's a peacefulness, an ease to it. There's an interesting story in this regard. Is Joseph Campbell, who is a mythologist and psychologist. Writer, he was an Olympic class runner before he became a notable scholar and writer, and much of his writing was about religious experience and mythology and the sort of psychology of the spiritual development and such like, and. When somebody asked him, had he ever had a mystical experience, what he described was what happened on a running track one day. And he was a half miler. So that was the 880 yards, or what would be 800 meters in metric. That was his speciality. He was doing a relay, and he was the anchor leg. He was the last one to run in a four-person relay. And so his team, they were running against another college, and his team was way behind. The runner of the opposition team was way, way ahead, like 70 or 80 yards ahead down the track when he got the baton for his final leg of the run. And he said, as soon as the baton landed in my hand, I knew this is my race. And he said his mind went completely quiet, and he literally ran the race of his life, and it was completely still inside. And like there was a sense of peacefulness and clarity and stillness as he is running the race of his lifetime. So going back to your initial question, that when we are dealing with difficult situations or having to handle the people around us who are in states of agitation or there's contention or problems in the world around us, then applying the mind, using mindfulness and wisdom to attune to the situation, to see what's going on, how do I handle this, what's the best way forward, that use of wise reflection, attunement to what's going on, and then letting that attunement inform action and speech. And so that attunement can result in, okay, at this moment, don't say anything, just be still. And then 3 seconds later, okay, now's the time to speak up. And then the mind doesn't have to leave the quality of mindfulness and wisdom as you're speaking. And that's why what we call a Dhamma talk is supposed to be a Dhamma talk. It's like the person gets out of the way and the Dhamma speaks. That's the principle of it. And that the whole process of like choosing words, choosing actions, what to do, what not to do, the more complete that the the heart and mind are attuned to the reality of the situation, then the more that words and actions that will be beneficial for everybody involved will be likely to arise. You can't control everything, but you can do the best that can be done, and that some things are under within our personal area of control, and some things are out of our personal area of control. But you can act to the fullest extent of your capacity, and then also when that quality of mindfulness and wisdom informs action, then even if what you did didn't seem to fix anything or help anything or have a beneficial effect, there's no regret. There's no sense of, oh, I should have done better, or it could have been different. There's more a confidence in that everything that could have been done was done. It was out of my hands. Okay. You're not happy that a painful result occurred, but you're also recognizing the limits of your own capacity, so that the mind doesn't create self-view around regret or self-blaming or those kind of habits of selfing of various types that form around that. Any other? Yes, Gaspar, please take the microphone.
Thank you, Ajahn. So, as I was preparing in my mind to ask this question, I was trying to be aware of what is going on in the body and experiencing the suchness of the situation. So then I notice how my heartbeat starts to become elevated in excitement of, or in fear of asking a stupid question. And then my palms of the hands start sweating, etc. And so while there is the awareness of these processes, they don't seem to stop them or sort of inhibit them in a way, although they do provide me the opportunity to see clearly that, oh, okay, that which is knowing is very different from that which is being known. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering whether cultivating this sort of attitude of noting the suchness can help us in some way, I don't know if this is a good word, but intercept the sort of the thoughts or the feelings that seem to go automatically. I'm not sure if this was a clear question, but any reflection is appreciated. Thank you.
Yeah, sometimes that appreciation of the suchness of things, it does have a sort of an impact upon the felt experience. Sometimes it doesn't. I remember years ago, and we again before we had the temple, the fortnightly recitation of the monks' rules we used to have in what's now the sewing room. That used to be our shrine room, in the monks' vihara. And Ajahn Sujito was doing the recitation that day, and he'd been chanting. It's called the Patimokkha, the monastic rule. And so, and he'd been chanting the Patimokkha for many, many years. It was not a particularly unusual thing for him at all. So he was the chanter, and the rest of us, as the male monastic community, were gathered around as he was chanting. And when the Patimokkha had finished, he made the comment. He said, "That was really interesting, because my heart was really pounding, my tongue felt like a dead tortoise in my mouth, my armpits were pouring with sweat." Words to that effect. I can't remember the exact wording, but it was that kind of thing, that his tongue was a sort of dead lump in his mouth, and his throat was dry, his armpits were pouring with sweat, and yet his mind was saying, "Well, this is interesting. You know, I seem to be very anxious." But the voice that was the inner voice that was saying, "That's curious. I'm rather anxious here," but there was no anxiety in the attitude. But the body was having this whole kind of "I'm on the spot" reaction. But he said it was so distinct that the attitude, that which was knowing this physical reaction, was very cool and easeful, while the body was having its anxiety. Oh, everyone's paying attention to me. I've got to get this right. I don't want to get this wrong. Eek, what will happen if I make a mistake? That sort of programming that happens when you're at the center of attention. And I've always remembered that and noticed those kind of things sometimes where you can find that quality of clarity, you know, even when there is some sort of intense reaction going on, physical or emotional. You know, that you can be having some kind of intense experience, and then there can be that same kind of clarity and ease with it, that it's not suppressing it or sort of dissociated in an unskillful way, but it's recognizing, well, this is really busy. this is a lot of tension. I didn't realize I could feel quite this much tension. Look at that. So there's a feeling of it, a real genuine appreciation. But I just, as you were saying, and I say the same thing myself very regularly, that which knows agitation isn't agitated. That which knows the heart beating, it's not agitated in the same way. And that's really a key to the development of mindfulness. And in the third of the Satipatthanas, the Cittanupassana, contemplation of mind states and moods, it spells that out quite simply and quite clearly. Knowing the agitated mind is agitated, knowing the unagitated mind is unagitated, knowing the expanded mind is expanded, the contracted mind is contracted, knowing the mind filled with lust is being filled with lust, the mind free of lust is free of lust, and so on. And it says, just to the extent of knowing there is this, kind of in a similar kind of language, here it is. This is the mind filled with anger, so that which knows this is the angry mind isn't angry. And I feel it's one of the most significant and simple, straightforward teachings that we have in the Pali Canon, a really clear meditation guidance that spells it out, that if it's really developed, if that mindfulness is fully developed, then in that moment there can be a lot of agitation. But that which knows the agitation isn't agitated. Or like with Joseph Campbell and his run, it's like, here's the experience of me, you know, running the race of my life, but I'm not going anywhere. Absolutely here. So that I feel it's a skillful guideline to use. It can. As with everything, we have to be attentive, because there can be a way that the mind dissociates and sort of spaces out or gets abstracted. Do you know that word? So it's like there's an unskillful dissociation, and so it is a kind of non-attachment, but it's in a way spaced out, and it's not really in tune with Dhamma, with reality. And it's I'm just watching, but you're not just watching, you've actually brought a barrier down. And so that it's not just watching, there's a nihilism, a negating going on there. And so it's important in the meditation to not be developing that skill of negating and just blocking everything off and say, I'm just observing, I'm just watching, and that mistaking that dissociation or abstraction for a non-attachment. Because it's like, again, if we go back to using the Buddha's life as an example, as a sort of archetype of spiritual practice, he completely the Buddha mind, the Buddha totally transcended the world, but he was totally attuned to the world. And so if you read the suttas or the Vinaya, he was extraordinarily observant and attuned to the time, the place, the situation, who he was talking to, what kind of language would be meaningful to them, when it was time to speak up, when it was time to leave things alone. So that there was, along with that total transcendence, kind of having let go of the world completely, as it says in the teachings, that he was had completely let go of identification with personality and as it says, he's cut it off at the root, made it like a palm tree stump, deprived it of the conditions for existence and made it incapable of arising in the future. Any aspect of the body or feelings or perceptions whereby you could define him, define the Buddha, is completely dropped. It's like totally let go. The bridge is down. No connection. But even though there's complete transcendence and non-attachment to the five khandhas, you're totally attuned to the five khandhas at the same time. And so it's a non-attachment and non-entanglement that is not based on a dissociation or a dismissiveness, or like, everything is empty, therefore, why bother, or I don't care. Everything is empty, therefore, pay attention. And so it can take a while to get a feeling for how that works, and that that non-attachment can drift into that sort of numbing. But I feel what we mean by the middle way is really characterizing that balance of total attunement and a total non-entanglement at the same time. So maybe to continue a little bit. What do we mean when we use this word wisdom? From birth to death, this is the way it is. There's always going to be a certain amount of pain and discomfort, unpleasantness and ugliness. And if we're not aware of it as it really is, see it as Dhamma, then we tend to create a problem out of it. The span between birth and death becomes all very personal. It becomes fraught with all kinds of fears and desires and complications. We suffer a lot in our society from loneliness. So much of our life is an attempt to not be lonely. Let's talk to each other. Let's do things together so we won't be lonely. And yet, inevitably, we are really alone in these human forms. We can pretend. We can entertain each other. But that's about the best that we can do. When it comes to the actual experience of life, we're very much alone, and to expect anyone else to take away our loneliness is asking too much. When there's physical birth, notice how it makes us seem separate. We're not physically joined to each other, are we? With the attachment to this body, we feel separate and vulnerable. We dread being left alone, and we create a world of our own that we can live in. We have all kinds of interesting companions, imaginary friends, physical friends, enemies. But the whole lot of it comes and goes, begins and ends. Everything is born and dies in our own minds. So we reflect that birth conditions death, birth and death, beginning and ending. During this retreat, this kind of reflection is highly encouraged. We contemplate what birth is. Right now we can say, this is the result of being born, this body. It's like this. It's conscious and it feels. There's intelligence, there's memory, there's emotion. All these can be contemplated because they are mind objects. They are dhammas. If we attach to the body as a subject, or to opinions and views and feelings as me and mine, then we feel loneliness and despair. There's always going to be the threat of separation and ending. Attachment to mortality brings fear and desire into our lives. We can feel anxious and worried even when life is quite all right, so long as there's ignorance, avijja, regarding the true nature of things. Fear is always going to dominate consciousness. But anxiety is not ultimately true. It's something that we create. Worry is just that much. Love and joy and all the best in life, if we are attached to them, are going to bring the opposite along also. That's why in meditation we practice accepting the feeling of these things. When we accept things for what they are, we're no longer attached to them. They just are what they are. They arise and cease. They're not a self. Now, from the perspective of our cultural background, how does it appear? Our society tends to reinforce the view that everything is me and mine. This body is me. I look like this. I'm a man. I'm an American. I'm 54 years old. I'm an abbot. But these are just conventions, aren't they? We're not saying I'm not these things. Rather, we're observing how we tend to complicate them by believing in the I am. If we attach to them, life becomes so much more than it actually is. It becomes like a sticky web. It gets so complicated. Whatever we touch sticks to us. And the longer we live, the more complicated we make it. So much fear and desire comes from that commitment to I am, to being somebody. Eventually, they take us to anxiety and despair. Life seems much more difficult and painful than it really is. But when we just observe life for what it is, then it's all right. The delights, the beauty, the pleasures are just that. The pain, the discomfort, the sickness are what they are. We can always cope with the way life moves and changes. The mind of an enlightened human being is flexible and adaptable. The mind of the ignorant person is conditioned and fixed. Whatever we fix on is going to be miserable. Being a man or being a woman as a permanent belief is always going to make life difficult. Any class we identify with, middle class, working class, American, British, Buddhist, Theravada Buddhist, grasping to any of these will produce some kind of complication, frustration and despair. Yet conventionally, one can be all these things. A man, an American, a Buddhist, a Theravadan. These are merely perceptions of mind. They are adequate for communication, but they're nothing more than that. They're what is called samuti dhamma, conventional reality. When I say, I'm Ajahn Sumedho, that's not a self, not a person. It's a convention. Being a Buddhist monk is not a person, it's a convention. Being a man is not a person, it's a convention. Conventions are as they are. When we attach to them out of ignorance, we become bound and limited. That's the sticky web. We're blinded, being deluded by the convention. When we let go of the conventions, we don't throw them away. I don't have to kill myself or disrobe. The conventions are all right. There's no suffering involved in any of these if there is the awakened mind seeing them for what they are. They are just as they are. They are merely a convenience, expedient to time and place. With the realization of ultimate reality, Paramatta Dhamma, there is the freedom of Nibbana. We are free from the delusions of desire and fear. This freedom from conventions is the deathless. But to realize this, we have to really look at what attachment is. What is it all about? What is suffering? And attachment to the I am process. What is it? We're not asking anybody to deny themselves. Attachment to the view of being nobody is still somebody. It's not a matter of affirmation or negation, but of realizing, of seeing. To do this, we use mindfulness. So there's a few essential themes there, and I think that one of the points that he makes is how, as long as there's attachment to the body and the personality and views and opinions and feelings as me or mine, then we feel loneliness and despair, and that is a very much an archetypal form that as soon as a mind takes hold of the I am, then there's a not I am. There's that when the mind takes hold of me, I am this, then there's a lot of other, and then the experience of the other is then threat. And then following that feeling of threat or fear, there comes a desire to get something that will protect me from the other. So it's how the feelings of self, of fear and desire are all sort of generated in relationship to each other. And that and a lot of our meditation is seeing how that works. As long as there's an I am there, then see what gets generated by that. And when the I am is let go of, when these conventions are seen through, that being a man, being a woman, being a nun or a monk, a layperson, our age, our nationality, that these can only be conventional truths. So there's no thing absolutely there, that then there's an ease, there's a freedom in relationship to the convention. So it's not a matter of defying the conventions. As you said, you don't have to kill yourself or disrobe or blame the conventions for limiting us, but rather it's the attitude towards the conventions. That's the thing that makes the difference. And so much of the, not just the meditation, but also how we live and use the conventions of our human life and our community together, that learning to use the conventions skillfully so we relate to them with sincerity and appropriateness to the situation, but without being defined by that, and making a person out of that. So it's again, it takes a bit of time to get used to the terminology and relating to what we mean by these kind of words. But it's interesting that the word person comes from the Latin persona. Per means through, sona is sound. So it means a persona is a mask, like that you put in front of your face. So right there in the English word, there's a clue that the personhood, it's a mask. That's covering up the reality. That it's a big clue. That the personality, it's the mask. It's like, yes, it's a mask that we put on. And the different masks that we wear in our different roles. If sometimes we're a child, sometimes we're a parent, sometimes we're leading, sometimes we're following, sometimes we're the doctor, sometimes we're the patient. You know. That we wear different different masks, different personae at different times, but if we realize it is just a persona, it's just a mask, a seeming, an appearance, then it can really work for us. And that during this time also, that Lumpur Sumedho would often make comments like that he was not interested in turning people into a bunch of Buddhists. As a sort of an identity, or someone's having an ordination ceremony, that he would make it clear that taking on the robes is not an identity; it's a skillful means. It's a vehicle. It's not a personality or a persona that is to be attached to or identified with. Like anyone who wants to be a monk, in order to be a monk, you know, go away. You need to change your attitude. It's not. A kind of a social role, but it's a vehicle that you get into to make a journey. So, any questions, thoughts, reflections? Any people out there? It's Venerable Attadasi, the purported Venerable Attadasi.
Thank you, Atan. I would like to ask something connected with what you were speaking at the beginning, a bit connected with the whole reading. It's about getting obsessed with different things. And in my experience, I...
Being obsessed with what?
Yeah, with different things. Getting drawn in, getting into something. And in my life, particularly as a monk, I notice how often... my mind gets very obsessed of, for example, absorbing different kind of knowledge of different fields that sometimes don't have to do necessarily anything with Buddhism. And I can see that obsession that maybe for some periods I can get obsessed, for example, studying history or things like that, or science. And I can get into it, and after that period, I just completely forget that, and as I can see, I think what's the point of starting that after, no? So I would like to know. I would like to ask for advice if to what extent is particularly for a Buddhist monk to get onto this kind of study of different fields that they don't have anything to do with Buddhism.
That's a good question. I think different things have effects on different people. So it's good to, you know, say if you put your mind onto something, some kind of quote unquote interesting reading that's about ecology or about mathematics or about history, and then after you've been reading that or looking at that, then what's the effect on your mind? How much of it is there during the meditation? What's the result of that? Is it causing the increase of suffering or the diminishing of suffering? what's the result? So that what is called vimamsa, looking at the results of the choices that we've made and the things that we've done, that's really the only reliable guideline, because for some people the way that their mind works, they can say absorb a lot of information, a lot of knowledge, and just sort of it goes into the back drawer, and then it is sort of useful or interesting, and then it doesn't have any ongoing impact. For somebody else, they might read a lot less, or something that's sort of more superficial, but it stays in their mind and goes around and around and around. And so you can't predict how that's going to be. I feel that so both looking at the result of say looking reading that kind of literature, but also it can be that if you get totally absorbed in Buddhist literature, you kind of buried in the suttas or the Vinaya or the Abhidhamma, and you're kind of so kind of wrapped up in Buddhist material, you know, that can also have an agitating effect. And so I launched into this with a good intention, hoping to understand more, but I'm just filling my mind up with lots and lots of stuff. So it's good to look at that. But also along with looking at what the effects are afterwards, that looking at the intention before. So you say, I got some spare time, I'd like to read another couple of chapters of that really interesting book. And just to take a moment to think, well, do I really need to? Or is what's motivating that? Is that something really valuable? Or am I just feeling lonely and wanting to eat something, but it's evening so I can't, so I'll read something instead just to kind of be somewhere else? So it's good to look at the intention beforehand as well. But I would also encourage you not to be too idealistic, because we can say, you know, the perfect monk, you know, if Venerable Atadasi, if he really had his practice together, if he was a perfect monk, then he would be like this and he wouldn't be like that. He'd always do this and never do that. And you can easily create this sort of idealized image of how we should be, and then the effect of that is to be continually failing. Well, not continually, but falling short of that ideal. And so I feel that, you know, keeping within the bounds of the precepts, then looking at what you want to do before you do it, looking at the results of it after you've done it, and then letting that guide you, that's the best thing. And sometimes, you know, even though it's not a good standard to keep, sometimes it just like if you're feeling really sort of restless and sort of stuffed up and anxious, just going out for a long vigorous walk just to sort of clear the cobwebs, as they say, that can be a really useful thing. just you know, it's only going for a walk. It's not going to bring total enlightenment, but it's useful just to sort of work the body and to stretch the legs and to get out there in the fresh air. So similarly, sometimes the Lumpo Sumedho would, if he saw that somebody in the community was kind of really kind of uptight or filled with a lot of anxiety or self-criticism, you know, he might kind of give them a book and say, here, read this. You know, you might find this interesting. Just, you know, give the mind something to chew on, or to not always say, no, 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 I shouldn't. Or if you do follow something through and think, well, that wasn't really particularly beneficial. Sometimes the mind just needs a bit of a break. People using the workshop say, don't use the workshop during the winter retreat. that no need to build anything or create anything. But for some people, you just need to blow off steam a little bit. And I feel that Ajahn Chah's style of teaching and practice, one of the reasons why that we have these large communities and so many branches, is that Lumpu Cha really understood that. You know, you can, if you try to live too much according to an ideal, it's like very, very few people can really function well that way. And that most of us need some kind of an outlet, and that different things to put your mind onto. And so, I find that for myself. I mean, my kuti is stuffed with books, so I can't really discourage people from reading. And I find very non-Buddhist subjects, like I've been reading quite a lot of about quantum mechanics recently. It's not particularly Buddhist. I mean, there's kind of ways that it is Buddhist-ish, but technically speaking, quantum mechanics and Buddhism don't really have a lot in common. But I find it's interesting reading. But I feel we, as human beings, we do need those kind of outlets. If the outlet becomes larger than the main part of our life, then things are getting out of balance. If it's all outlet and no inlet, that's not. Well, you know what I mean. It's like if you're sort of extracurricular. You know the word extracurricular? Like if you're in school, the things that are outside of the classroom. If your extracurricular Buddhist activities are larger than your Buddhist activities, then things have got out of balance. But those kind of things are just there as a skillful means to just give yourself a bit of a breather, like stretching your legs and such like, then it can be something that's very useful. And I think coming from the place of practical attunement to the way it is, rather than the perfect venerable Atadasi would be this way. If you start from the reality of how we are, rather than the ideal of how we should be, then those things, we find a way with them that has a natural balance, and that we don't overdo it, we don't get too lost or carried away. Well, one winter retreat here, I was leading the winter retreat. Both Lumpur Sumedho and Ajahn Sujito were away. And my second monk, even though there was a sort of don't spend unnecessary time in the workshop during the winter retreat, he actually built a stupa in the center of the courtyard. There are some photographs of it. It started off with him visiting Blaine's workshop and saw that all these worn out tractor tires and tires of different sizes that were being recycled, and he had the idea, oh, you could pile up a few of those and make a stupa. You know, Amaravati doesn't really have a heart. It was before the temple was built, and the cloister was just a car park, and we don't really have a heart. We don't really have a focus for attention, and so during the winter retreat, whilst I was trying to focus on the meditation practice and the teachings, my honored and respected second monk was not only building the stupa out of car tires and tractor tires, but he was casting concrete Chinese lanterns, the cast iron baffles from the old boiler house were made into a circle, like in the Sanchi stupa, there's this sort of stone fence around the stupa. He thought, you know, those are magnificent, these great metal pieces. You can't just recycle those, send them to a scrapyard. They could be part of the stupa. So it was called the Heart of Gold Goodyear Memorial Stupa, I think was it finally got called. There are a few photographs of it. So the whole thing came into being during the winter retreat. So there'd be the buzzing of machines up in the workshop pretty much continually. And then every so often you come out in the morning and, oh, look, you know, lanterns. Oh, look, you know, a spire. Oh, look, a cast iron fence. Oh, look. So, but he had a lot of juice, a lot of creative energy, and it was just the reason why I'm telling the story. I'm not encouraging people to go and lock themselves into the workshop or build another stupa. But he needed a big outlet. He was a big guy and a powerful creative mind, and so he was very generous in other respects in terms of the community. But it was just, okay, I'll just, not exactly, you couldn't really turn a blind eye because it was literally right in the middle of the of the monastery. But it was, okay, you know, that's an outlet. You know, he needs to blow off steam. And so by the end of the retreat, we had the Heart of Gold Goodyear Memorial Stupa. It was right there in the where the fountain is in the middle of the cloister. So I'm not encouraging that degree of distractive activity, but I felt, you know, in following the example of you know, Lumpur Cha, Lumpur Sumedho, that's how this guy is, and he's really good-hearted. He's very generous. He's really competent. He's doing a really fantastic job with building this golden stupa made out of car tires, tractor tires. Just let him burn off steam in that way. And so that, yeah, I think working with the way we are, rather than say, no, you shouldn't do that, stop that, stop it, stop it, stop, stop. People can be obedient and submit to a form, but it's not done skillfully. There's a building up of pressure that can then be destructive in many other ways. So I will leave it there for this evening.